As we've been developing this idea of a biblical worldview, we've had the three main stages. Started with creation. We saw how God created everything wonderfully. And in creating everything, we were reminded that we want to look at the world around us as part of God's creation. And it showcases who God is. And also we see ourselves as made in God's image, as male and female, fulfilling God's mission here on the earth. But then came the fall with Adam and Eve. We spent several weeks with that, and we realized because of the fall, though our creation is beautiful, it's now broken. And sin has corrupted everything. It infects us as people. And now we are naturally selfish and rebellious against God. And when we're confronted with our sin, we all love to hide our sin. We all love to whitewash it and pretend it's fine. And that's the essence of the fall. It infects us as people, but it affects everything around us. All of creation is affected by the sin. And what we're going to do now is begin looking at the idea of redemption or restoration. What is God doing, not just interacting with sinful people, but how is God going to fix this? That's the question that we have. How will God fix such a broken world? And a world infested with all these roach people who ruin everything. And that's the idea of what we're looking at here with the account of Genesis. To start with, though, I think it's worth considering this painting. This is a painting by Spanish painter Elias Garcia Martinez. It's a classic take. A lot of painters try to focus on the face of Jesus and what he looks like. And the museum where this is housed is they take pictures every few years of what it looks like. And so they took a picture in 2010 and then 2012. And a local lady saw that the painting was really deteriorating. And different stories tell different things. She says she got permission from a priest to take the painting home and try to restore it. And so she took it home. And other restoration experts think maybe what happened is she tried to clean it all first. And in cleaning it, it took a lot more paint off. And then she tried to fill in the paint with her own paint. And so she brought it back to the museum. And then a little bit later, they, you know, keep photographing the pictures to see how they change over time. And they resulted in this, which is really horrific. And it was, you know, kind of like a scandal or such a travesty. And people are just mourning. Oh, this wonderful painting from hundreds of years ago. What did you do? And she says, I just tried my best. They're really funny, right? I'm thankful that God doesn't restore the world to make it look like this. He makes it better than the original. But the question is, how do we restore something? How do we fix something that's so not just faded, but broken and ruined? And let's kind of make another illustration, not just a painting illustration. I think in terms of you have a nice shirt. I'll use my kids. So they have a nice shirt that they're wearing to church. But then in the children's church, they decide to do tie-dye for fun or finger painting. Let's do finger painting. And finger painting, they're messing with it, but now it gets all over their shirt. And they rip the shirt up some because they got in this nasty scissor fight. And their shirts are horrible. How do we fix it? We don't do that at our, for the record. We don't do finger painting or scissor fights at our church. But for the illustration, how do we fix it? That's the question. How would God fix something that's not just broken, but ruined? And it's infested. And the people who are on the earth, they're the ones responsible for it. That's what I want to look at. And I'm going to suggest three broad steps. And what the Noah's flood really focuses on is these first two. What we do is you remove the impurities. With that painting, the experts are hoping that the kind of paint she used is paint that can slowly be extracted and return it back to the original, and then they can improve it. And so this is the essence of what God is wanting to do here. He's wanting to remove the impurities. And so you'll see the traumatic idea is removing the impurities. And then number two, retain the purities. That's the idea of God's grace. Let's just wipe the slate clean. Get rid of everything that's ruined. But let's keep what's valuable and good. And then we'll restore the entire thing. That's the process of what God does in redeeming everything that we see. And the account of Noah's flood really focuses on these first two steps. And I cannot wait, probably 2 weeks from now, when we get to the third step. And that would be the best of all. But we're going to see how God is at work right here. And to do that, we want to kind of set the stage again, introducing ourselves for what God is doing with this restoration process. We looked last week a little bit of Noah's world and what it was like. Oh, that's later on. But we're going to be looking in Genesis 6, so I'm going to suggest that you open there. And we'll be going walking through Genesis 6 and 7 and 8, a little bit of 9. But again, we don't have a lot of time, so we may definitely save some of 9 for later on. But we finished last time at the beginning of chapter 6, and we saw that there was this scandalous transgression between the sons of God and the daughters of men. And at that time, I kind of suggested that it could be... Well, there are two general opinions. What if it's Seth's descendants? And those are described in chapter 5, but they're now mixing with Cain's descendants in chapter 4 or other people. And then some people think maybe it's like there's this demonic influence. It's a part of it. And as I tried to do a little more reading and research this week, I think my conclusion is both. That in the account of Genesis, it seems to me that the sons of God are referring to these godly line of Seth. And that just matches the account of Genesis. Chapter 5 is all about Seth, and after Seth, they begin to call on the name of the Lord. Here's this line from Seth down to Noah. And in that you have Enoch, who walked with God. You have Lamech, who recognizes this is ground which the Lord has cursed. The truth of creation and the fall has continued down. But as you get closer and closer to Noah's time, you have less and less people believing. And look how chapter 6 is described. Verse 2, they saw that the sons of God, they saw the daughters of men were beautiful. The Hebrew word is good. And they took these wives for themselves. And because of that, God gives them a severe judgment. And that sounds familiar. Someone who sees something as good, they take it for themselves, and God gives a punishment. This matches the fall. There's a lot of parallels between the fall and even the creation account and what we'll read here in Noah's flood itself. So I'm going to suggest that both are involved. And there are other verses in the New Testament, specifically 1 Peter chapter 3, references spirits who were disobedient during the time of Noah. So in my mind, it could be both. There's heavily demonic influence here at this time that encouraged people to sin so much. But at the same time, there are humans who are responsible for this. So we need to take care of the humans as well. Isn't that a nice political answer? Everybody's right. But I think that's the essence of that. Anyway, we want to summarize Noah's world in three basic ways. And we'll describe, first of all, that it's full of people. It's just full. And we mentioned this a little bit last time. Trying to estimate how many people are on the earth. Remember, Adam and virtually everybody in Adam's line were alive for over 900 years, each person. And they had sons and daughters throughout that time period. And looking back at chapter 5, verse 3, Adam has Seth at how old? 130 years old. And then he lives and has more children for... after he became the father of Seth, verse 4, for 800 more years he has kids. You can't imagine how many kids. You have generations overlapping. And I did just a few referencing to some websites. You try to pick the more official-looking ones, and they're trying to use mathematical formulas. And the general consensus is it's very likely that the population at that time was in the billions of people, likely more than we have today. Because it's over 1,000 years, 1,500 years. So that world was fully developed, and it was full of people. It wasn't just full, but I'm going to suggest it was also very strained. And the idea is, how do you have the natural resources to provide for all these people? Especially at the end of chapter 5, Lamech names his son Noah because he hopes this one will... I'm looking at chapter 5, verse 29. He says, this one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands. That's arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. Lamech senses just the frustration of the ground not producing like it should. And all these people here add to that the idea of violence. So that's the last idea. It's full, and it's just strained or just limited, and it's extremely violent. I'm going to go down to chapter 6, verse 11. Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Then God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me. Like we said last time, they've crossed the line. they have a countdown. Because of this, behold, for the earth is filled with violence because of them, and behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth. And the idea of this violence, this is something intentional, and it's aggressive, I'm going to hurt you, and it's always harmful. And apparently the earth is full of it. So we think our society would be bad if we have people running rampant on the streets, no law or order, no restraint of the justice system. Apparently, this is common in that world. Everybody hurting everybody else. And no justice system, just revenge, back and forth. You hurt me, I'm going to hurt you. And if the food is limited, it's just this natural, just this constant frustration. To the point where, who is still believing in God? Who is still righteous? How many people are still righteous? Well, technically, we focus on just one person, Noah. Out of all of these likely billions of people on the world, who is still trying to walk with God? One man stands out. And besides that one, everybody else has turned. And if that matches the idea of the line of Seth, the ones who are trying to worship God, they're mixing with everybody else. No one in the line of Seth is still worshiping God. Just one person. And it shows the extent of just how quickly sinful depravity just swarmed over the earth and ruined everything. And it's really interesting seeing how God concludes then. He says here, what's the cause of all this? He calls it corrupt. Look at verse 11. The earth was corrupt in the sight of God. And then verse 12. God looked on the earth, behold, it was corrupt. Why? Because all flesh, all people, had corrupted their way on the earth. It's almost as if... because of the nature of all this intense corruption, it's like it pollutes the earth. The earth is stained with the violence of the people. And that would remind us of a few other accounts earlier in Genesis, right? Because Adam sins, the earth is ruined. And then think of the sin of Cain. He kills his brother, and what does God say? Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground, and now you are cursed, and the ground will not respond to you. Just as Abel's blood stained the earth. It's almost like in God's mind here, it's not just that people need to be removed, not just the people are impure, it's like the earth itself is stained. We just got to go a rinse cycle. Let's just cleanse it all and refresh. And we see that idea. Verse 17. God tells Noah, behold, I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish. And we'll see this later on as well. God destroys not just people, but even animals. Everything dies that is on the earth. So there's this cause of a corrupted earth, and the effect on God is really powerful. We'll look back at verse 5. God sees the wickedness of man. And as a result, verse 6, it's really interesting here. The Lord was, what's the word that you see?
Grieved.
There are two different words there. The first word, the Lord was sorry, perhaps, that he had made man on the earth. Do you see any other word there at the beginning of verse 6 in your translations?
Regretted.
And that can start to raise questions in our minds. This is like the edge of what we understand about the character of God. I thought God doesn't make mistakes or look back like, oh, why did I? Or I wish I didn't. Did he make a mistake when he made Adam and Eve? And this gets kind of, this gets in like thin ice for us. I'm not uncomfortable. How could God regret something? But we are firmly convinced from the scriptures that God has a plan. And we know that he doesn't have a backup plan. This is his plan all along. And what's neat is in this case, this is God simply expressing emotion in response to what he sees. Just as several examples, a parent grieves as they see a child who's being punished. I regret that I have to do this. This hurts me more than it hurts you. I haven't said that yet. but that could be part of it. Think of Jesus in John 11. He wept at the tomb of Lazarus, knowing he's about to raise Lazarus from the dead. Why weep if he's going to come back to life? Well, he's grieving. And so I think in my mind, this just is portraying the emotion of God, and any grief that we feel is just a reflection of God as the ultimate source of all life or all emotion. If anyone knows how to grieve, it's God. And can you imagine the level of grief that he experiences looking at this perfect world that he's created, and now it's completely ruined by these people that he's created. And they've rebelled against him, and they've infected everything. You know, everywhere he looks, all over the whole world, you see that summary in verse 5 again. Every intent of the thoughts of their heart is only evil continually. Nothing is good. So it grieves him, of course it would. And I think that makes the solution so much more powerful than what's the result? I've got to give a sentence. And the sentence I'm going to give, it's got to be complete judgment. I'm sorry, so it was, the first part is he was sorry. But then at the end of verse 5, or end of verse 6, it says he was grieved. And I want to add a little bit of ideas to that idea of being grieved in his heart. This is, as can describe someone who's almost offended or insulted, and they've got to do something about it. And I'm going to give you two verses that you can write down here. The first one is Genesis chapter 34, verse... Oh, you see it right there. Yep. Genesis 34, verse 7, and Isaiah 63, 10. And we may go to chapter 34, verse 7 really quickly to see the context here. And the concept is someone has been hurt or insulted or offended in such a way that they've got to take action. Chapter 34 is really just a sad account. It starts with one of Jacob's daughters being taken advantage of. Essentially raped. And what's really sad is Jacob's response, verse 5, when Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, what did Jacob do about it in verse 5? Chapter 34, verse 5. He kept silent. He didn't do a thing. Oh, wow. Well, I don't want to make waves. Let's just wait. And then verse 6, they go out to speak. And then verse 7, I'm sorry, this is the big one. Verse 7, now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and there, here's our word, they were grieved, and they were angry because he had done this. And the rest of the chapter is about what they do to take care of it. You hurt our sister, you will pay. And the grief is some emotion that stimulates them to act. No, you didn't. And we're going to have to seek justice, in their version of justice, against you. Isaiah 63, verse 10, this is describing God. And I'll just read this for us. As they rebelled, he's referring to the children of Israel, they rebelled, they grieved his Holy Spirit. Therefore, he turned himself to become their enemy. He fought against them. They grieved him. Therefore, God took action against them. So the grief here is not, you know, God's like mourning at a funeral. Oh, I'm so sad. And he's kind of staring at the fireplace. And he's not, it's not just emotion. This is being stimulated to act. This is God acting to defend his honor and to reclaim his world. This is God acting. And that's the essence of this response, the effect that it has on God. So this is grief that drives him to action. This is emotion that leads to action. And so that's what we'll see then with this idea of the sentence of judgment. He gives that sentence, verse 7, what does the Lord say? Because of this, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land. He's going to blot him out. I'm going to remove this humanity. They are so wicked and so corrupt. They are ruining everything. And not only them, but look at the end of verse 7. What else? Man to animals, to creeping things, to birds of the sky. For I am sorry, that's the same regret, that's the same emotional grief that I've made them. And this conclusion is, I need to remove all of them. So he predicts this, and again in verse 13, he tells Noah the same thing. We read this down in verse 17 as well. Verse 17, I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh, in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish. And so what God is doing with Noah is he's predicting, here's what's going to come to you, Noah. What's amazing, though, is remind ourselves, how long does it take for Noah to build the ark and for this sentence to actually come? How long does it take? Long time. 120 years. It takes that much time. We saw that back in chapter 6, verse 3. But later on as well, we just kind of do the math that fits the timeline. So it takes 120 years for Noah to build this ark and for God to warn. And can you imagine that in a courtroom setting today? The judge says, all right, your verdict, guilty. Sentence, death. In 120 years. Anyway, we laugh at it. That's the mercy of God again. So it's not just sentence predicted, but again, it's delayed. And during this delay, it's really fascinating to think about what's happening here. A few scriptures from the New Testament help to round this out. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 3 describes Noah as a preacher of righteousness. So it could be that he is preaching as he's building. And we saw as well last time that his father and grandfather was still alive up until almost right before the time of the flood. Then they pass away right before the flood comes. So maybe they're active in this role. They're too old to build, but they can preach. We don't know for sure. But in this case, there's this 120-year period. Noah is actively building. And during that time, no one listens to him. And Jesus refers to this in Matthew 24, verses 37 to 39. Jesus says, "For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah." So what were the days of Noah like? He says, "For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away." So what's happening during those 120 years? They are being warned. They see this gigantic billboard as Noah's building this ark. A huge reminder. Why are you building this ark? Well, judgment is coming. Hebrews 11 describes that Noah is moved by fear. He's afraid of this prediction. He's going to believe what God says. Does anybody believe? No one believes. In fact, they're living their lives like normal. Nothing's going to happen until the actual day that he goes in and they see these animals parade past them into the ark and God himself shuts the door. Then they realize, because they didn't even understand. These are people. It's a delayed process. And then it's executed. And as you read these accounts, you know, there are two impressions I have of God. I'm really trying to see this story from God's perspective right now. You know, God has declared the sentence, he's delayed it, but now he's about to execute it. On the one hand, you sense the grief of God. I've got to destroy that which I've created, and it's like heartbreaking to do it. But simultaneously, you have the righteous anger of God. I must take care of this right now. I must establish justice and remove the issues here. And so that's what happens. We'll look at 11 and 12, verse 11 and 12, in the 600th year of Noah's life. How does the flood come? It's really interesting to look over this. There are two big ideas. How does it happen? End of verse 11. On that same day, we see the fountains of the great deep. So apparently these underground water reservoirs that were kept in the earth, somehow there's a split in the earth and the water shoots up and kind of invades from below. So imagine in Noah's day, nothing big happening, but all of a sudden these huge geysers shooting up and just filling that layer of ground where you're standing. And at the same time, what else is happening? End of verse 11. And King James says it's the windows of the sky. NASB says the floodgates of the sky. Apparently there's such a huge reservoir of water above the earth. And some scientists think this is maybe what could have allowed for the longer lifespans because we're more protected from the sun's rays. There are interesting theories there. But generally, here's this huge reservoir of water above the earth, and that splits open. So guys are shooting up from underground, gigantic water coming down from above, and it just immediately begins to cover the earth and start to develop this rising level of water. It's intense. How long is it? How long is it raining? What do you see? Verse 12, 40 days and nights, constant rain. So not just like, you know, gushing waterfalls, but we've been in really intense rain before. You feel like it's just coming in sheets, right? That's the description. Sheets of water just soaking the ground. And the people are realizing, this is it. This is the judgment of God. It's sobering. I'm going to have us go down to verse verse 13, they enter the ark, and then down in verse 17, and actually, I wanted to, well, you're not supposed to see the other one. I was supposed to delete this. Oh, well. I want us to listen to it. Listen to it being read. This is Max McLean. He does a great job of reading the scriptures, but we want to use as many senses as we can. So he's going to start reading around verse 17 of chapter 7, and we want to get a sense of what this is like. And all of its just sobering reality. And he reads it with the judgment of God. And just sense how total is the justice of God here.
All flesh went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. Everything on the dry land, in whose nostrils was the breath of life, died. He blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those who were with him in the ark. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days.
So, powerful, right? What phrases stood out to you in that reading?
Died. Death.
They died. They all died. I like how he slowed down. Only Noah was left. But that's the point, right? Everything dies except for the one man. And you just are horrified at the extent of that kind of calamity. Just recently, we had the anniversary, 10-year anniversary of the tsunami that hit East Asia. And we remember the images of that, right? The water flooding in. This is worse than that. This is not water flooding in. This is water coming up out of just and coming down. And it's rising so high. I'm going to assume here, in this case, the flood is global because it covered the mountains. And, yeah.
A few years ago, my sister invited me up to the, well, I shouldn't have said that first, but anyway, she's in the Catskill Mountains. She's about 1,700 feet above sea level, and around their house, you know, it's kind of sandy, and there are some rocks in there, and I pulled out a couple of rocks, and they had seashells in them. And I'm saying to myself, how do seashells get 1,700 feet above sea level? And then I've read that there are accounts of people finding the same thing, like in the Andes Mountains of South America, like 9 and 10,000 feet above sea level.
Yeah,
it's crazy. We have evidence in the world today of this.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But imagine you put yourself in Noah's situation. I mean, you're in this ark. It's just you by yourself, and everywhere you see, there's just water. And 40 days of rain, but the 150 days of this level rising to the point where now it's 15 cubits, 23 feet above sea level, or above the mountains. So there's no land mass at all visible. And that this is God's judgment and God's cleansing of the world. And I'm not a geologist, so I'm not even going to pretend to understand what could have happened next, whether continents drift apart or how the fossil layers develop or all these oil deposits come from. But anyway, it's traumatic. It's horrific. But it's absolutely necessary because God will not allow his creation to remain polluted. God will not tolerate anything imperfect. No one's going to ruin what I've done. This is God's jealousy over his creation. Yeah, Jack.
Is there anything in Scripture that God wanted, you know, to eliminate everybody, you know, like now on the flood? Is there any hint of why God didn't just eliminate Adam and Eve from the very beginning and start over?
Yeah.
Is there any hint about that?
That's some of the deepest questions we ask, right? We spent a little bit of time on that a few weeks ago, and the short answer is, this is best.
What's that?
This is best. This is God's best plan. And it's warning, warning, warning. Delay judgment. But yet judgment will come. But it's better to restore a broken world than to keep it innocent and unbroken at the beginning. And I've thought about this a little more since then. We don't really see the work of the Son very clearly until the world's broken. And then he comes to earth and redeems it. So the Son doesn't get the glory he deserves unless he comes and redeems us. So one entire person of the Trinity doesn't receive the glory that is uniquely his unless the world is broken. Anyway, we want to finish here. This is the judgment of God, but that's not it, because he wants to retain the purities. There are people who can receive grace, and we see this from Enoch. He's the one who walked with God. He followed God, perhaps, could be the blank there. And this is from over in chapter 5. And it's really interesting, we're not given much detail, and that's what makes us even more curious, right? Chapter 5, verse 22, Enoch walked with God 300 years. And then down in verse 23, all the days of Enoch are 365 years. So at least 300 years, Enoch has a close walk with God. And the result, verse 24, Enoch walked with God, and he, well, depending on your translation, he was not, he disappeared, wasn't there. Was he raptured? Is that what that looks like? We're just not told. Why? Because God took him. God just brought him up. You don't need to be here anymore. Your soul must be so grieved with all the violence and the sin around you. Just come back. Come up to me now. And that's the conclusion that God comes to. It's interesting, Jude references a prophecy of Enoch. And in Enoch's day, he's prophesying the Lord coming with thousands of holy ones to bring judgment. When we connect all the dots, we realize that's going to be fulfilled in Jesus' second coming. Enoch walks with God so closely, God allows him to see and be able to predict the second coming of Christ. Not that he understood everything between now and then, but he was confident that God would come with justice. And there's a lot of Jewish tradition about Enoch, apocryphal books about 1st Enoch and things of that nature, which is intriguing to us. But we want to focus on Scripture itself, which tells us he walked with God. And in my mind, there's no greater obituary than for someone to say, that man walked with God. And he was not because God took him. God said, all right, you've had enough of this miserable world. Let's bring you back up to your natural habitat in my presence. And then there's Noah. Noah, he believed God. That's the big thing here. Hebrews 11 focuses on this. He believed God. He took God's word, God's warning seriously. He's moved with fear, and he listens to God. Everything God says to him, he listens to, and he takes seriously. And so we'll kind of work our way through this, kind of shift our focus from God's view, looking at the world. Now put yourself in Noah's situation. And you're Noah, and here's how God interacts with you. He warns you before the flood. We're going to look back to chapter 6. And he's told to build this ark. But it's interesting, the first thing, well, description of Noah, verse 9, he's a righteous man, blameless in his time. Within that generation, there's no one who's blameless except for Noah. And Noah, there's that same phrase, Noah walked with God. And the connection with that as well, verse 13, God gives him the warning. The end of all flesh has come. The earth is filled with violence. I am about to destroy them. So here's your command, verse 14, Noah. Make an ark. And it's interesting to think about the dimensions of the ark. It's 300 cubits long, essentially 1.5 football fields, American football fields, long, 150 yards. Long, long, big space. And then it's essentially 75 feet wide and 45 feet high. How many stories are there? What do you see? Look at verse 16. There's a window. That's nice. At the very top, there's a door in the side to walk in. How many floors? Three floors. Interesting. And I was trying to have that picture of Noah's ark under construction there, but I didn't. Here it is. So, and you're familiar with the Ark Encounter. This is the close to the Creation Museum in Kentucky. They tried to build a life-size version of Noah's Ark. We haven't been there yet, but everything we've heard is that you go there, you realize, this is a really big boat. Like a lot of creativity and long time. It probably did take 120 years for a handful of men to build this huge boat. But it also makes it sound realistic as well. This is not a children's story with giraffes poking their heads out the window and, you know, little birds flying and Noah and his wife take up the left third of the ark. This is a huge boat with lots of space for animals. And you see, so God tells him to build the boat. What's interesting as well, God at that point warns about the flood, verse 17. But then verse 18, even before it comes, 120 years before it comes, God already tells Noah, I will establish my covenant with you. You're going to enter the ark. And I'm going to bring all these animals to you, Noah. Animals and birds. And so because of that, verse 21, you need to get ready. Your job is to build an ark and gather food. Lots of food. All that which is edible. And it'll be good for food for you and for them, the animals that are coming to you. And what's really neat, verse 22, how does Noah respond? Chapter 6, verse 22. He did. He obeyed what God had commanded him. And verse 22 covers 120 years. During that 120 years, Noah just did what God told him to do. He believed God, he was walking with God, and by God's grace, he was able to plan and build this gigantic boat with the help of his sons' wives. He hired hands, we don't know, but he did it. And he's the one who's responsible. Now, chapter 7 begins the actual process of getting into the ark. So verse 1, enter the ark. Again, God repeats this evaluation of Noah. I have seen you to be righteous before me in this time. And take seven of these clean animals, and he'll use the clean animals to give a sacrifice at the end. Bring them with you on the ark, because in 7 days, that countdown has gone from 120 years to 1 week. We've got 1 week till D-Day. Here it is. You have 1 week left. Get ready and have all the food ready, because the animals are coming to you. It's really neat that Noah didn't have to go all around the world to find these animals and hunt for just the right beetle that could be the parent for all the other species of beetles. God just brings them to him. And so we see this played out. Verse 6, Noah is 600 years old when the flood of water came. Verse 7, Noah enters the ark. Who else? Verse 8, clean animals and birds, everything that creeps on the ground. They went into the ark to Noah in pairs, by twos, male and female, just as God had commanded him. It's neat that a simple principle, whatever God commands us to do, he will enable us to do it. And apparently 120 years is enough time to build an ark and get the food, but I'll bring the animals. Don't worry, I'll do my part. And all these animals come towards him there at the ark. And people raise objections. How can you fit all the animals in the world on the ark? Right? What are some possible answers you would give in that kind of scenario? Someone's debating the reality of the story, the historicity of the story. How can... Come on.
I think engineering students at Georgia Tech looked into this.
Really?
And they calculated that, yeah, it's entirely possible.
Hmm. Yeah. So Georgia Tech, there you go.
Well,
two-word answer.
Not very convincing.
That helps. What else could we say?
Baby elephants.
Baby elephants. Yeah, not full-grown elephants.
Or like, the smaller. And then one of each kind, mm-hmm. more than... Mm-hmm. Every single type of dog.
Yeah. So look at verse 14. They all came in. The story kind of repeats these main details again. Verse 14, they and every beast after its kind, cattle after their kind, creepy thing that creeps on the earth after its kind. Does that sound familiar? Sounds like the creation story, right? All of these according to their kind. And there have been some kind of discussions, what is a kind, right? Is that equal to species? Or is it like the level above? Is it orders before species? So maybe that's the level. So then you have one dog or one wolf that represents all the breeds of dogs. And there's enough genetic variety within that one ancestor wolf that all these breeds can develop out of it. So we don't think every single kind of animal, well, what is a kind? That simplifies the question somewhat. Some of my favorite questions would be like, were dinosaurs included in the ark? If they were alive at that time? I know they're all extinct, as far as we know. Let's say has a few dinosaurs, but then the earth has changed so much that as soon as they get off the ark, they die and they can't survive the new environment. We don't know. Or did God make them all herbivores during the time period? These are fun questions. But in my mind, these questions do not take away from the truth of the story. The story is true. That's our those are the glasses that we're wearing right now as believers. We believe the story is true. We have some interesting questions that rise in our minds, but we're also convinced that the God who can send an entire flood over the world is also capable of reorganizing a few animals on the ark for a year or so to make sure that they survive until they come off later on. But this is Noah. So God has warned him. He preserves him during the flood. We read in verse 16 that God shuts the door on him. And you can imagine then, from Noah's perspective, you're in this ark. You're hearing this rain pound on the wood above you. And you kind of know the water's rushing around. This is where you start checking with your sons. You waterproofed this thing, right? You know, how did we do that? We did it right? I think we did. We couldn't have a practice run. But this is God's plan, and He helped us, so we're confident that God's going to keep us safe. And it starts to shake and shift a little bit as the water rises. And they start going up, and they rise higher and higher. Ears pop to adjust to the air pressure. I've seen paintings of people kind of coming up to Noah, kind of banging on the ark. Let us in, let us in. That doesn't really match the scriptures, though. These are people who don't understand, and for them to want to ask for mercy, that doesn't fit the account. And frankly, the water's rising probably so high, they didn't have time to swim over to the ark and reach out to it. It's almost instantaneous. But my question is, what's the timeline look like? And we'll kind of look at that here. What's the timeline? And I tried to summarize it a little bit by dates. So Feb 2 is the second month, the 17th day is when the flood begins for 40 days of rain. Some of those facts I may have meant to delete. I can't remember. But increases till July 17th. Yeah. So I'm just doing our month. So February 17th it starts. 5 months later, this is chapter 8, verse 3. It went up until the height when it's higher than the mountains was there, but then it comes down and it hits Ararat 5 months later. So imagine 5 months. You've been going up higher than the mountains. God, as far as we know, God didn't tell Noah how long this would be. 5 months of seeing nothing but water. And then you're used to the floating sensation, and then, you hit this mountain 5 months in. And it's interesting, I guess this is some of the notes I took earlier. In chapter 2, man is caused to rest in Eden, and that kind of parallels the idea of the ark resting in Ararat. And then two and a half months later, finally they can see the mountains. It begins to drain or evaporate up. That's a lot of work. And then the earth becomes visible, but there's still puddles of water until February 27th. Over a year after the flood begins, it's now completely dry. It's a long time. But I want us to appreciate, though, look at chapter 8, verse 1. God remembered Noah. While sending all of this judgment on the earth, God remembers Noah and preserves him the entire time. And He preserves him in such a powerful way. So we're going to say He remembers Noah, and then after that He reassures him. And we'll have a lot of time here, but the end of chapter 8, Noah is told by God to come out. Remember, He sent the birds out to see, is it dry enough to come out? And he's trying, but then ultimately, God tells him it's time to come out. And so he finally does. I'm going to skip down to chapter 8, verse 15. The Lord God spoke to Noah, saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife, your sons, and your sons' wives with you. Bring with you everything you brought in with you." Apparently, none of the two animals has died. Can you imagine how nervous you'd be? I mean, zoos have a lot of pressure to make sure no animal dies under their care. Can you imagine Noah, if that dies, that species is gone forever. So make sure they're taken care of. But he does. God preserves them. They all come off. Every creature who went on comes off. And they begin to spread out. And so Noah leaves. And it's neat now in verse 20. How does Noah respond? Chapter 8, verse 20. How does Noah respond? He builds an altar and he worships God. He offers this burnt offerings on the altar. The 7 clean animals and 7 clean birds are already being used the day they come off the ark. Imagine for him, it's kind of nerve-wracking. I only got 7 of these. I'm going to use one right now. I'm giving away 1/7 of all this amount of possessions that I have of these clean animals. But God is worth it. And it's neat the effect on God now. God smells the soothing aroma. And the rest of the chapter is God talking to himself. I will never again curse the ground. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And it is God kind of concluding, okay, from now on, people will still be evil from their youth. They don't become juvenile delinquents. They're born as delinquents. And they're born sinful. And that's the expectation. And he knows that. But he's never again going to destroy the earth this way. Peter gives some explanation here. Verse 22 is interesting. That reminds me a lot of the song, Great is Thy Faithfulness. Seed time and harvest and gold and cold and heat, summer and winter. That's reflecting some of the phrasing here in this verse. But God predicts then, while the earth remains, never again will I disrupt everything like this. This is God's mercy, his grace on them. And then chapter 9, he blesses Noah with his version of this blessing. Be fruitful, multiply. Chapter 9, verse 1. Here's all the food now. Animal meat is completely fine. But warning, don't eat it with blood. And by the way, that matches the idea of shedding people's blood. And he repeats the idea of capital punishment. If someone sheds man's blood, by man his blood should be shed because that person was made in the image of God. You destroyed God's image. When you killed that person, and therefore you must die in return. Perhaps that could be some of the preventive, not allowing violence to grow so much. If there's capital punishment, people are more hesitant to kill people, I would imagine. And then at the end of middle of chapter 9, he uses the rainbow and establishes this covenant with them. And again, God repeats, when I see the rainbow, I will remember the covenant, I will not flood the earth. And it's a promise of protection for them and for us. Anyway, let's kind of bring it to a close then. What are the two... Oh, that's one last nice picture I found. What are the two concluding ideas we have then? Simply, judgment is certain. And this is how God really began to challenge my worldview this week. I was studying this over, and I'm realizing that judgment is absolutely certain. People walk around as in the days of Noah, eating and drinking, marrying, getting married, whatever else, doing their daily routines, not understanding that judgment is coming, but it is certainly coming. And it really struck me, I was at a coffee shop during this, and I'm just watching people walk past me on the street. And it sobers you. Every person I see will be judged by God. They will die. They will face the judgment of God. And properly understood, that compels us to want to warn people and share the gospel with them. Jesus Christ is their only hope, and if we do not, everybody we see, every human being will die and stand before God in judgment. This is not God being mean. This is God being just. Because we're evil from our youth. And this is the biblical worldview. We're sobered by this reality of certain judgment. And then we're also in awe of the fact that the grace of God is costly. He will preserve people, but at great cost. Judgment is no joke. And obviously we've pointed now to Jesus Christ on the cross. Jesus had to die the most painful, agonizing, sobering death, experiencing the wrath of God, because that's what judgment requires. That's what justice requires. So that grace that God can extend to us is so costly, but it's also possible for us. And so we can respond then, rejoicing in God's goodness and eager to share this message of hope. I guarantee you, if you warn people about judgment, they will not take us seriously, right? They laugh at us. You're one of those doomsday people. But it is true. And that's where we want to follow Noah's example and be people who are being warned by God, removed by fear. By faith, we build an ark. Because we're convinced this is coming. And for their sake, we share it urgently with them. Because the day will come when they will face judgment. And it's God's mercy that he gives us one more day, like we saw last time, to give them another chance to repent. So let's really allow God to change the way we see people, that we see our world,